This is Chapter 18, Tests and Invitations. During the last class of the day, near the end of the lecture review, the classroom door flew open and Jackson came in.
"Don't mind me," he said to the executive he'd interrupted, though from the way Jackson strutted, it was clear he enjoyed the attention.
"Just posting the new messenger list."
Every student in class sat up straighter. The new messenger list. It was well known that the list hadn't changed in over a month. Now Charlie Peters' departure had left an open slot. Who had filled it? As Jackson hung the paper at the front of the room, everyone strained their eyes to make out the names. Kate was the only one sharp-eyed enough to succeed.
"No luck yet," she whispered to Rainey. "Your name's not on it."
The moment class was dismissed, the students swarmed toward the list. Martina Crow, the first in line by virtue of her sharp elbows, announced that Bonnie Hendrickson was the new messenger. This prompted a collective moan of disappointment. Still, no one stepped out of line. Everybody wanted to see for themselves, perhaps hoping Martina was playing a joke, or that Bonnie's name would magically disappear, replaced by their own. The mysterious Benedict Society had gathered near the back.
"Let's get out of here," Kate said. "It's Bonnie, all right. I saw her name."
"You three go on," said Rainey, who felt strangely compelled to see the list up close. "I'll meet you on the plaza." And so the others left, and Rainey got in line, wondering why he felt drawn to look. Perhaps he was not so different from the other students after all. Perhaps he, too, hoped for something impossible.
"The secret privileges," said a girl wistfully.
"And those tunics," said a boy. "I'll get on that list if it kills me."
Rainey leaned sideways to see who was at the front of the lines. Rosie Gardner and Eustace Crust, the two special recruits. Despite their confusing behavior, Rainey still suspected them of having been kidnapped, and he found himself wondering yet again how they had come to be so pleased with their fates. Those initial dazed expressions long since evaporated, the special recruits were all eagerness now, and both had greedy glints in their eyes. Rainey watched them leave the room with an unexpected pang of sympathy. Who had they been before? Had they, like Sticky, run away from home? Had they ever known parents at all? What kind of miserable life had they had that the Institute seemed so wonderful to them now? As the line moved forward, Rainey had a flash of insight. He imagined the special recruits' futures as they themselves must imagine them. With nowhere else to turn, no parents or grandparents begging for their returns, they would devote themselves entirely to the Institute. They would rise through the ranks of messenger, wear their fancy tunics and sashes, and one day, when the time came, they would turn their backs on the outside world to become executives. It wouldn't matter how they had come here or what had come before. That part was already forgotten, or else would be forgotten in the pleasurable rush of being important, of being a part of something. Standing before the list now, Rainey didn't even look at it. His sympathy, he realized, had shifted into something else. A different feeling altogether. What was it? It certainly wasn't pleasant. Then with surprise, he recognized it. Jealousy.
"How strange," Rainey said to himself.
"What is strange?" said a man's voice. Rainey whirled to find himself face to face with Mr. Curtin, who stared keenly at him from behind his silver lenses. Lost in thought, Rainey had lingered after all the others had filed out. And now he found himself alone with the sender himself.
I beg your pardon, sir?"
"You said something was strange," said Mr. Curtin, drumming his fingers upon a great thick book in his lap. "I dare say you were referring to the messenger list."
"Oh, yes, sir," Rainey said, then lied. "I expected to find my name on it. I've been making perfect scores."
"That is what I thought," said Mr. Curtin. "The minds of children are easily read, even gifted children like yourself, Reynard."
I'm glad you think I'm gifted, said Rainey, sensing an opportunity. I want to become a messenger more than anything.
Of course you do, said Mr. Curtin. All the executives have reported how well you're doing. Both you and your friend George Washington have far exceeded expectations. In fact, in the history of the Institute, no one has ever mastered so much material so quickly.
Mr. Curtin's chair had been rolling closer, slowly, almost imperceptibly, so that now their faces were very near to each other.
It is a strange coincidence, is it not, that two such gifted children should be admitted to the Institute at the very same time, and that they should be such close friends?
Hidden behind those reflective lenses, Mr. Curtin's expression was difficult to read. Was he suspicious? Rainey's heart, already beating double time, kicked into high gear.
As for being admitted at the same time, he said, that is a coincidence. But it's no surprise that two good students should become good friends, especially if they're roommates.
True, said Mr. Curtin, with an approving crook of one eyebrow. You are a bright child, a very bright child, Reynard, and I believe you would make a fine messenger. Do you believe that yourself?
Oh, yes, sir, very much, cried Rainey, with as much enthusiasm as he could muster.
Good. But you must remember, Reynard, that you are new. Your time has not yet come. Not yet. It will come soon, however, if only you are patient. I trust you are capable of patience.
I'll do my best, Mr. Curtin.
That is all we ask, my boy. I must confess I am not a patient man myself.
Here, Mr. Curtin's voice changed. Where it had been briefly paternal and encouraging, it now turned searching.
Take, for example, your female friend, the diminutive Miss Contraire. I am losing patience with her. My executives have just reported that, although her quiz scores are improving, she remains quite unruly, sleeping during lessons, refusing to speak when questioned, making sour faces at the executives, that sort of thing.
Inwardly, Rainey groaned.
She doesn't seem to be dedicated, Mr. Curtin went on. Her insolent behavior contradicts her quiz scores. I don't understand her motivations. And when I don't understand something, Reynard, it is natural that I don't trust it.
Perfectly natural, sir, Rainey agreed. But you know what they say about people you don't trust.
No, said Mr. Curtin, lifting one eyebrow. What do they say?
If you don't trust them, keep them close.
Mr. Curtin burst out with a screechy laugh that made Rainey jump.
Keep them close, very good. There is even more to you than I thought, Reynard Muldoon. Very well, I'll keep her close, as you do, and perhaps one day she will prove useful.
Perhaps so, Rainey said. He had the distinct feeling that something between them had changed, as if he had passed a test. A test I didn't know I was taking, he thought, with a curious sense of déjà vu.
Yes, keep them close, said Mr. Curtin, stroking his chin. He seemed to be considering something.
Yes, that is the best way to control the problem.
And control is the key, my boy. Never forget that. Control is always the key.
No, sir, said Rainey. I won't forget.
Mr. Curtin smiled.
Very well, Reynard. I have decided something. I should like to speak with you further. Come with me to my office, won't you? Step along, quickly now. I hate to waste time getting from one place to the next.
And spinning his chair about, Mr. Curtin rocketed from the room. Rainey hesitated only long enough to take a deep, deep breath, then hurried after him. Mr. Curtin did hate to waste time. Rainey had to run to keep up with him. Through the empty corridors and across the cafeteria, where the helpers were busy preparing supper, Mr. Curtin never slowed, not even when he approached the door onto the plaza. Slamming it open with the front of his chair and scattering frightened students left and right, he zoomed across the plaza and the rock garden, his wheels spitting up bits of gravel that stung Rainey's arms. Racing along behind, Rainey saw his friends across the plaza, staring after him in wonder and not a little apprehension. He waved to reassure them, though at this moment he could have used some reassurance himself. As Mr. Curtin banged through the door to the Institute Control Building, it occurred to Rainey that every door in the Institute must have been designed to be opened in this violent manner. Mr. Curtin clearly would not bear having to wait for a door to open, nor to wait for any lagging students, and so Rainey hurried on. They passed down a number of door-lined corridors, which must be the recruiter quarters and executive suites. At last, they came to a plain metal door, whereupon Mr. Curtin stopped so abruptly that Rainey, who had expected him to smash it open without slowing, almost ran up against the back of his wheelchair. Now he saw the numeric keypad beside the door. Mr. Curtin kept his office locked. Directing Rainey to look away, Mr. Curtin punched in the number code, the door slid swiftly open, and Mr. Curtin shot into the office. Rainey had to leap forward before the door closed again. Mr. Curtin's office was an oblong, white-stoned room with no windows. It seemed bony and cold, like an empty skull. The bare stone floor had not even a rug, and there was a drain in it, perhaps for the sake of cleaning. High on the wall behind Mr. Curtin's desk, in a heavy silver frame, hung an old map of Holland, Mr. Curtin's place of birth, Rainey remembered, along with several sketches of Stonetown Harbor and Nomansen Island. Beneath the sketches stood a row of locked cabinets, bookshelves, Rainey realized, but locked so no one could get at the books. Mr. Curtin's desk, a dull, polished, Spartan metal affair, was carefully organized with file boxes and short stacks of paper. On one corner of the desk sat an artificial violet in a pot. The flower looked perfectly real, was in excellent condition, and unlike Mr. Benedict's live violet, required no care. How strangely similar the two men were, Rainey thought, and yet how utterly different. Mr. Curtin motioned for Rainey to sit across the desk from him, then set his large black book upon the desk. It was clearly an old book, with a binding that had been mended more than once, and with several pages dog-eared throughout. The book fell open to a place Mr. Curtin had marked with a paperclip, and Rainey saw that the pages were covered with handwriting. It was a journal. Mr. Curtin was drumming his fingers on the desk and regarding Rainey in silence. It suddenly occurred to Rainey that perhaps he was expected to speak. Did you want to show me something in that book? Mr. Curtin frowned. This book? Certainly not. He reached forward and snapped the journal closed. I was only collecting my thoughts, Reynard. Tell me, what do you think of my map? I saw you looking at it as we entered.
Your map of Holland, sir? It's quite lovely.
Isn't it, though? Mr. Curtin said, his tone shifting to fondness. I was born in Holland, you see, an orphan, like yourself. I spent my childhood there, too, and a terrible childhood it was, taunted and bullied, ridiculed and abused by other children. I don't miss my childhood, but I do, on occasion, miss Holland, a country with an admirable tradition.
If you don't mind my asking, sir, why did the other children torment you?
I do mind your asking, Mr. Curtin said coldly, but then he collected himself and said in a friendlier tone, "We both know you've had similar experiences, do we not, Reynard, for being different?" Rainey hesitated, then nodded. "People are capable of great wickedness, Reynard. They cause each other misery. This is why I'm particularly proud of my work. Despite having been persecuted myself, my chief goal in life is to bring happiness to all." He smiled a tight smile.
a smile that gave Rainey the feeling Mr. Curtin half believed what he said, but also that something else, something much larger and darker, lay beneath.
"Now, Reynard, to the point," said Mr. Curtin. "I don't believe there's ever been such a clever student at my institute as you. You have a shrewd, strong mind. I saw this at once. And you are a natural leader."
"I don't know about that, sir. I..."
"Don't argue with me, Reynard," said Mr. Curtin. "I dislike contradiction."
"Sorry, sir." Mr. Curtin's tone softened.
"A natural leader, I say. Oh, you may not see it yourself, but I dare say I can see a bit more than you. The way your friends gather about you, the way your enemies wish to destroy you. Don't think I haven't noticed these things. It is familiar to me, you see. You remind me of myself at your age."
"I'm flattered, sir. I'm sure you were a brilliant student."
"No doubt," said Mr. Curtin with a smile. "And I had my share of enemies, too. Children despise superior minds, you know, especially in leaders, who must often make unpopular decisions."
Rainey thought suddenly of Kate and Sticky, who had been so shocked at his suggestion to cheat on the quizzes. But they didn't despise him. He knew that.
"One problem with being a leader," Mr. Curtin was saying, "is that even among your friends, you are alone. For it is you, and you alone, to whom the others look for final guidance."
Rainey felt a pang. That was true, he thought. He did feel that way sometimes.
"I'm not saying this is your experience now," Mr. Curtin went on, "for you are only a boy. But in your future, you may wish to choose carefully with whom you associate. No point in being a regular sort of person, Reynard. You have a greater calling, a duty to yourself, and you must pursue it with all your heart and mind."
"And how should I do that?" Rainey asked.
"This is what I'm arriving at," said Mr. Curtin. "When you are a little older and more experienced, I have you in mind as an executive."
"An executive?"
"I see you are amazed. You should not be.
No, the question is not whether you have the ability to be an executive. You have that in abundance, but whether you have the inclination. You are an orphan, I know. No doubt you have little to miss in your old life. And so I urge you strongly to consider what might constitute a new life, a life as an executive."
"Well, from what I've seen," Rainey began. Mr. Curtin screeched, that is, laughed, and cut Rainey short.
"Ah, yes, what you've seen. There is more to being an executive than what you've seen, Reynard. There will be soon, at any rate. See here, I am about to tell you something only my executives and a handful of messengers know. You're to hold this information in utmost secrecy. If it comes back to me, I will know it was you who told it. Do you understand?"
Rainey could not imagine what he was about to be told. His heart and stomach seemed to be switching places inside him, then changing their minds and switching again.
"I understand, sir." "Very well," said Mr. Curtin. "Here is the secret. Things are going to change, Reynard. They are going to improve. I will not say precisely how. That will come later, after you have proven yourself. Suffice it to say that the Institute, as you know it, is destined to change. Grand things lie in store. The improvement is quite near, and after it has occurred, there will be no such thing as messengers anymore. Much to the heartbreak of my students, I know, but it is for the better."
Rainey almost started in his seat. No more messengers? Why not?
"Even so," Mr. Curtin was saying, "I shall still need executives, and I intend to keep on a few of the best messengers to groom for higher service when they come of age. Obviously, I am thinking of you, and perhaps your friend George Washington, too, though about him I am less certain. He possesses enormous talent, but I fear the fidgeting belies an underlying weakness. However, I am loath to dismiss him out of hand. I have an open mind, you see. In fact, he added with one of his short, screeching laughs, open minds are what I prize most. Mr. Curtin pressed a button on his chair, and the office door slid open. Rainey was being dismissed. Thank you, sir, Rainey said, stepping out into the corridor, where Jackson stood waiting for him. Don't thank me, Mr. Curtin called as the door slid closed. Impress me! When at last the lights were out, the girls had descended from the ceiling, and Rainey had told his friends everything that had happened. The first thing Constance could think of to say was, You don't trust me?
Come on, Constance, Sticky said. That's just what he wanted Mr. Curtin to think. It's better than having him suspicious of Rainey, too, you know.
Kate pretzeled up her legs and thrust her chin into her hands.
The improvement, she said. So that's what Mr. Curtin calls the thing to come. And he said he won't need messengers anymore.
That's what he said, said Rainey, but I knew better than to ask why. I still need to prove myself to him.
Well, we'd better pass all this on to Mr. Benedict, Sticky said, climbing up onto the television.
As soon as the coast was clear, he sent their report, outlining all they'd learned. Mr. Curtin called the thing to come the improvement. It was coming very soon, and messengers wouldn't be needed. A few minutes later, a response began flashing among the mainland trees.
Here it comes, Sticky said.
Do not worry, the message said, and then after a short pause, but do hurry.